The dramaturg is there to honor your freak streak, not to suppress it.
Stop! That is, yes, if we made a banner for dramaturg, yes, that would be what needs to be on the banner.
Hi, y'all. Today on Bus Ride Talks, I speak with playwright and dramaturg May Truhoff Ali on what dramaturgs are and what we are not, learn about treacherous goats and public school scandals, and at long last, discuss the magic and pain of cooking. Let's get to it.
We're here.
Hello.
Cool. Hi, May.
Hi, Divinia.
Thank you for joining us today. It's so good to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm really happy to be here. I love talking to you.
I feel like I get to talk to you more than I ever have before recently.
And I'm so here for it.
It's amazing. We met for exactly one day at Playwrights Horizons, yes, and was just like, maybe I'll see you again. I really hope we get to communicate again. And then because all of the crazy things that happen, I know we talk like not every day, but like at least once a month. It's a strange month if I'm not talking to you.
Yeah, exactly. I start to miss you if it's been a couple weeks.
Oh, that makes me happy.
Yeah.
Well, there are a couple of things. So I know you in a lot of different ways. You are an amazing playwright. You're also just a writer in general. You're a dramaturg. You do so much great work. You're based in New York right now. But one of the things I don't know and I haven't had the pleasure of witnessing is you as a dramaturg. So tell me a little bit about what that looks like for you. And because we have some theater people listening, because we don't have some theater people listening, we can have fun trying to answer the question of what is a dramaturg?
Oof, what is a dramaturg? No one really knows.
Nobody knows.
Dramaturg is a German word.
Oh, you know things. I didn't know that.
I mean, doesn't it just sound so...
It does.
German and guttural? Anyway, so one of the really special things about the role of the dramaturg is that it changes drastically depending on the play that is being done and the needs of the other artists in the process. So sometimes being a dramaturg means you're making a research packet, and you're like
providing...
My least
favorite definition.
Yes. although sometimes, like, I've made some pretty lit research packets, and I'm sure
sometimes
you have
too. Sometimes
it's
fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes, like, you can really get into it.
Yeah, and I like to define research broadly. Like, it's not just a bunch of JSTOR articles, although I do love a good romp through JSTOR. It's also, like, here is music that is important to the playwright and was important to them as they wrote this. Here is art that evokes the world of the play. Here's poetry. I mean, you can get really creative with how you define research. So sometimes it looks like that, a sort of culling together of materials that are meaningful to the content of the play. Mm-hmm. And other times you are working with a brand new play that's just been written or is not fully written, and you're sort of like a midwife for the play, and you're like...
Oh, that's a new word.
Yeah. and you're like nurturing it into existence. I think of myself as a new play advocate.
Yeah.
So what I really, really love is that process of just like bringing new plays into existence and bringing those plays into like the truest versions of themselves. And sometimes I get to do that with my own plays and I'm the playwright. And sometimes I get to do that for the plays of other artists who I love and believe in, and then I call myself a dramaturg. But I think I'm doing the same thing no matter what. Like, if I'm in a collaborative process with a new play in question, like, whether the play was written by me or not, like, my creative impulses are coming from the same place of just, like, genuinely loving that collaborative process of like bringing a story into the world that wasn't there before.
Oh, I love that. You know, that reminds me of Jacqueline Backus wrote this article one time for a Playwrights Horizons like playbill where she was talking about how she approaches new plays. And one of the things she said was she asked the question to herself, I think she's like, you know, what delighted me about this, or some form of that question. And I try to keep that in mind, especially because when you work institutionally on literary work. So you're doing dramaturgy, but you're doing it sort of in a very business format. I think I know I at least like lose a little bit of that like delight focus and sort of figuring out what fits and what doesn't fit. But for me, I don't know. The best thing about like dramaturgy is that there's no, like, we don't have an answer for it because there's no definition, because we all do the same thing in different ways. Like, I approach dramaturgy from a place of questions. And I think what has evolved for me in the past couple months is realizing that my process is not play focused. Like, that is the thing that I'm working on, but the thing that I'm there for is actually my writer. And that's not necessarily any like better or more noble or like more honorable than people who are play focused or story focused or whatever it is that you decide to like use to do the work that we need to do. I just approach it from like, okay, I'm working with another person. What are the things that you need? And like fulfilling their needs to get them to the play that they want to be. But there's no one way to do it. There's so many ways.
Yeah. I can tell you what dramaturgy is not.
Oh, dude, please.
It's not like the structure police. It's not the people who come and tell you to clean up all of the weird, unruly stuff in your play. Yeah. You know, a good dramaturg isn't going to be like, well, this doesn't make sense, so you should cut it. A good dramaturg is going to be like, this doesn't make sense, let's lean into this and, like, really get our hands dirty in it and, like, you know, roll around in this messiness.
Right? Like, just figuring out what those things are. It's just, like, hitting, like, pressure points, hitting questions, just prodding. Yeah. But in a gentle way where you don't feel like you're being prodded. Because I know there's so much, oh, we're really getting into this. There's just so much bad blood between like playwrights and dramaturgs. And I really, it's not unjustified. That's like the worst part. It's really, sometimes it is justified. Like I hear the stories that people have like coming out of certain workshops and I'm like, oh yeah, I would also not want to work with a dramaturg ever again. Mm-hmm. I can do better for you and I'm going to do better for you, but I can see why that experience left a terrible taste in your mouth. Let me do what I can to give us a better reputation.
Yeah. Yeah, the dramaturg is there to honor your freak streak, not to suppress it.
Stop! That is, yes, if we made a banner for dramaturgs, that would be what needs to be on the banner. Honor the freak streak in your play.
Yes.
But you're also, you come from the side of a playwright, and I've done some playwriting. I'm also a writer, but that's not my primary thing. Plays are just going to have to wait for a while. But you have a lot of active plays. One of the ways in which I know you is that you're a commissioned writer for Adventure Theater MTC, and that's very specific in that you work, you know, you're working on theater for young audience work, but you also have a couple of other plays that you've been working on, one of which was workshopped a couple of months ago. Tell me a little bit about that.
Wait, which one are you talking about?
That's true. You actually, I forgot, you did do a couple of workshops. Let's talk about the goat play.
Okay, let's talk about goats. So, I hate that I had to ask that question.
Don't, that's it. Let's flex. You're here. Let's just flex on what you've been doing.
So I have this play about goats. True story. About 10 years ago, maybe 20 years at this point, I don't know. in the Galapagos, they were having a problem where all of the tortoises were dying out. And the Galapagos tortoise is like, you know, Darwin wrote about it. Like, it's a sort of mythologized, beloved creature that's incredibly special and amazing. And they found that one of the main reasons why the tortoises were dying out was because this invasive species of goat had just gotten so big and was just like, they were just consuming so much of the herbage.
Vegetation.
Yeah. That the island was dying and was drying up, and like the tortoises didn't have the moisture they needed to, you know, the tortoises were dehydrated basically.
That's a very specific problem caused by goats.
Yes, exactly. So scientists basically massacred all these goats, and they did it in this convoluted way where they had to turn them all against each other and, like, pick one goat and make it betray their herd, but then trick the goat into going to a new herd and betraying that herd, and, like, on and on and on and on and on. And at the end of all of this, all that was left were the traitor goats, which they called Judas goats. And the scientists just, like, picked up and left all these, like, miserable, lonely goats on the island together. So I heard this, and I was like, that's crazy. I have to write about this right now. So, yeah, the play is, there are two actors. There are three actors. Whoops. There are three actors, and they're kind of constantly switching species. So there are three actors, six characters. Okay. Lots of species.
I'm just stuck on the goat. I'm just stuck on the Judas goats. A, that they're called Judas goats.
I know, it's
B,
so cringy.
Our audio engineer Jake is just sitting there nodding as if they know the story of the Judas goats. Okay, Jake knows the story of the Judas goats. He's nodding again. I have never in my life heard of these traitorous goats. This is news to me. So I'm just reeling a little bit out here.
Yeah, it's a bonkers story.
That's crazy. And that's like, that's just science, I guess.
Yeah.
That's just how science works. I don't. Okay, there's a New Zealand war on goats. Jake, you're blowing my mind right now. I don't know what to do about any of this information. And you know, my roommate does not trust goats because of the shape of their eyes being different. And I think I might need to find that as, like, valid now, because what is this?
Yeah, I mean, they do eat voraciously. But you know who else eats voraciously and ruins their whole ecosystem? Is humans.
Deer? That's true.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, that's smart. See, this is why you're blurry. This is exactly how that works.
Yeah, so I find that endlessly fascinating. And the humans being in a kind of decision of, being in a position of deciding which species to kill and which species to save. And the ethical complexities of that. I just had to write about it.
No, I love that. So what is the title of the goat play?
Escape Goat.
Yes, of course.
I love a good pun.
We love a good pun. Genius. Yeah. So what is, okay, so when you're not writing about traitor's goats that also are called Judas goats, what is the other play that you workshopped recently?
The other play I'm working on is called ABCD, and it's about our public school system. And it's specifically about two standardized testing cheating scandals that happen at very different schools. Schools that are different in sort of like race,
like socioeconomic
makeup, okay, and socioeconomic makeup, and you know, this impulse to cheat, and, you know, the sort of signifier that it is that the system is actually not working for people in all kinds of schools. So it's kind of looking at the system as a whole through this, like, Tale of Two Cities structure.
Well, that's just fancy.
It's
interesting.
Fun.
So what about, is this based off of something that happened, or is this just something that you thought of?
I drew it from a couple sources. I did get really into reading articles about cheating scandals on tests.
Yeah, there were a couple for a while. I don't know why. I remember there was, like, a period where you just kept finding information about, like, cheating on, like, standardized testing and, like, what was going on in these schools around these tests.
Yeah, there's one article in particular called Wrong Answer by Rachel Aviv, which is just, like, riveting and devastating. It's about this, like, No Child Left Behind school that is, like, you know, they're super under-resourced and their test scores are really low and they're going to get shut down if they don't get their test scores up, but they just don't have the resources to do it in a fair and legal way. So they're literally just like, we have to cheat on these tests so that our kids aren't on the street. And it spirals and spirals and spirals. And that, I mean, I guess the common thread here is that I will, like, read or encounter something in the world and be like, this is messed up and twisted, and I don't know how to feel about it, and I have to write about it. Like, that's kind of where the impulse usually comes from for me. And yeah, like, I wrote the first draft of this play while living in Chicago, and my sister is a public school teacher in Chicago. So I was, like, visiting her classrooms, and, like, I knew a bunch of her teacher friends, and, like, that was kind of a part of my world. So I was also kind of thinking, like, you know, teachers are amazing, you know? They're public school teachers in particular are just, like, such superhumans.
There's so much to go through.
Yeah. And the idea of teachers cheating on tests from a place of devotion to their students is just such a it's such a fascinating complication to how I think about teachers. And also it, like, totally checks out with everything I know about, like, how teachers are exploited and overstretched in our system.
No, that makes so much sense. That's so much to, like, witness and take in at the same time. But that's also, like, one of the beautiful things when you ask someone, like, where did this idea come from? Where did this play or story come from? That's a lot more fun than, like, the why this play now question that we sometimes ask. It's just, what pieces did you pull together to make this creation? And it's always a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I also, you know, I went to a sort of weird high school in New York that was one of the, like, specialized high schools. And, you know.
What does that mean in New York school system? Because I don't, I know.
I roll.
Is it like private, or is it like one of those schools that's like, it's not a private school, but it's also like, but it's like a step above. Yeah, kind of thing. Okay.
You know, and a moment that was really pivotal for me for this play, but also in my life journey is when I was in ninth grade, I went to the senior graduation, and the graduation speaker gave this speech about how inequitable our school's admissions process was, and about how underrepresented Black and Latinx students were. And, like, it was just like it was a gigantic controversy in the school. Yeah. It was, like, I mean, it really just, like, ripped apart this lie that the school had been telling themselves of, like, we're a meritocracy. And that moment is something that has, like, really, I don't know. I feel like that was the birth of this play in a way.
That'll stick. That's big. I think graduation speeches are so, like, tightly. I remember one of my friends was, like, salutatorian at our high school graduation, and it's just, you know, the process is not just like, oh, like, you'll get on stage and write a speech. Like, no, they check and see what you're going to say. They want to make sure it's rehearsed. So that's someone being able to do that is always a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they want it to be like this big celebratory moment. There's family there. You can't hide from that. Once that's spoken, there's no hiding from that, because it's out there in a very, very public way.
Yeah. It was very divisive. And
did the school, like, not to get too far into it, but did they try to, like, cover it up, or did they talk about it?
I think the principal stepped down shortly afterward, and, like, this speech got written up in the New York Times, you know, like,
holy shit.
Yeah, like, it kind of sparked a controversy that colored the rest of my time in that school. And the thing about it was, it was saying things that I had always known were in the water, and that no one had actually put into words, and that anytime I had sort of, like, maybe asked a question about it, or, like, tried to, like, talk about it, people were like, mm-hmm. oh no, we don't have a race problem. Like, we're a public school, we're tuition free, like, we're a meritocracy, where you take the test, it's objective, you know? So, getting sober from the talented and gifted Kool-Aid is a process that has been, like, part of writing this play.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think I wasn't in, like, any of the talented and gifted programs. I did go to a school that you could test into if you were outside of that school's, like, boundary range.
Mm-hmm.
But that was more about, that was just a very different system. That was more about getting into a school that seemed better on applications and had, like, stronger programs for various reasons than a test that explicitly, because we know how tests work, especially standardized tests, that would probably explicitly still seem fair on the surface, but keep people out, mm-hmm. especially people of color, out on a school that's supposed to be fair.
Yeah. And, like, I think what I've learned mm-hmm. is how much those environments hurt the people who are in them, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's not, you know, especially if you are, like, one of the few people of color in one of those schools, it's like you don't really have any sort of, like, community to go to, and like, you're told that this is supposed to be the best thing that ever happened to you. And, like, I think like, I'm really going back and seeing hurt that was caused, or, like, you know, my sister's yeah. a teacher now, and, like, she'll say, like, this thing that happened, like, actually, now that I'm a teacher, I can confidently say that shouldn't do X, Y, and Z, you know, like, mm-hmm. sort of. I think there's so many things when you're a kid that you don't question or that you blame on yourself, and, you know, this play has been a really interesting exercise in revisiting all of that. Mm-hmm. And it's unearthed a lot of things that I sort of didn't question that I should have.
Yeah.
And that I'm questioning.
That's really tough work.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, I hope it's partially fun as much as it is probably deeply investigative.
Oh, it's totally fun. Like, there's a reference in there to, like, the falafel joint near my high school. You know, like, there's also, it's a love letter. In so many ways to, like, growing up the way I grew up.
No, that makes perfect sense. But while we're on education, mm-hmm. you have a very fun master's degree okay. that I want to talk about just a little bit, because it also is part of, you are international. So let's talk about it. Where did you get your MFA? Or is it an
it's
MFA?
It's an MPhil, which is...
Yeah. Explain that,
okay.
please.
An MPhil, it's a master's in philosophy in theater and performance studies,
okay.
which is a European degree. I got my master's in Ireland. Yes, that's the big reveal.
But, Ireland. A face was made by Jake, our engineer. It's the face. It's the face that I think I probably made when I met you, and you said, yeah, I just, like, was recently in Ireland getting this degree, and I was like, well, that's a thing that happens. Yes.
Yeah, I know. People are like, you know, I'm as much Irish American at this point as anything. Don't let any of my Irish friends hear me saying that, but
we'll keep it a secret.
But so I went to Dublin for the first time for Bloomsday. I took at my high school that I just spent a lot of time poo-pooing, the best class of my life, which was a class on James Joyce, and we literally just read an episode of Ulysses every week, and I fell in love. I think this book, like, taught me how to love in a lot of ways, taught me how to think, like, you know, I could do a whole other episode about, you know, why Ulysses rocks. But, so I went to Dublin for Bloomsday because I was in London working for my professor, and then I was like, I'm right there, I gotta go for the weekend for Bloomsday. So I went for a weekend to
Dublin.
What
is Bloomsday? Is that an Irish thing?
Bloomsday is...
There's a lot we don't know.
Yes. Bloomsday is a James Joyce holiday. So okay. Ulysses takes place all in the span of 24 hours, June 16th, 1904, and it takes place all around Dublin. So Bloomsday is sort of like this cult holiday where people come from around the world and they dress up as the characters of Ulysses, and they like go around Dublin to the different spots that are mentioned in the book, many of which are still there, and they just like read the book aloud. And you know, me being the theater geek that I am, like, this is like my jam. Like,
yeah, that's a good time.
Yeah, so I went to Dublin, had the best weekend of my life, and then studied abroad there a little later in college. And then applied for a Mitchell scholarship and got it, and like did a master's there.
Okay. Is a Mitchell scholarship, is it arts based?
No, it's like, so it's the George Mitchell scholarship, as in like the person who like mediated the negotiations in Belfast. And he like was largely responsible for bringing peace to the region. So actually a lot of the people I was with were like conflict mediation people.
Oh wow.
And then I was like this weird theater unicorn, but they were so into it. Like, they came to all my plays. They were so like gung-ho about it, and it was so fun. Yeah, so my master's was, it's called Theater and Performance Studies, which is so general, but basically we would like talk about like Marxist theory and like phenomenology and like post-colonial theory, and then we'd also see shows in Dublin and sort of like talk about the shows we were seeing in a sort of more you know, critical context, like the way you respond to shows. But it there was kind of like a new work component of it. And then there was this movement class that was just like, like, I cannot believe I got a master's to do this. Like, there was a 3-hour class where we just, like, rolled around pretending to be babies in the womb. There was a day where, like, the professor found out that a bunch of us, not being from Ireland, had never been to a bog before. So she arranged a field trip for us to just, like, go to a bog. Like, we drove out in multiple cars and just, like, stomped around in a bog. And she was like, this is our movement class. And I got a master's for just, like, stepping in squishy soil.
Movement teachers really are the best. Yeah. They are the best with, like, an asterisk mark. Because there's so much, I can't even get into it. I'm not actor-based, so I'm not going to get into it. But maybe one day I'll speak to an actor or a movement teacher, who knows. And we will discuss why they do the things they do.
I mean, if you're a nerdy playwright and your whole creative practice is text-based and is based in reading and writing, like, a movement class can be so scary and also so liberating, because you're, like, not trying to be, like, I had no skin in the game because I wasn't trying to be, like, a movement, a physical theater performer, you know? Yeah. To just be like, okay, I can just, like, roll around and, like,
see what
be
happens.
Free was, like, the most fun for me.
That's incredible. So you've spent a lot of time in Ireland. What is the theater scene there, if you know a little bit? Like, yeah. I'm interested in that.
The theater scene in Ireland is so, so cool because they have this really rich literary tradition, you know, and there's so many amazing playwrights throughout Irish history. You know, if you think about Beckett, if you think about, like, going back, like, Synge, Lady Gregory, and I'm not a big Yeats fan, but, like, we'll put him in there, because...
I have personal beef with Beckett, so...
Well, yeah.
But, like, who doesn't?
I love Sammy B. I love him.
I love Beckett. My beef is with, like, the way that his rights work and his writers.
Oh, yes. But yes. That's a whole thing.
That's another day.
But yeah, I mean, there's just this incredibly rich tradition. And so it's really a literary theater in a lot of ways. Like, it's still very playwrights focused, but also there's like, you know, they're connected to like the rest of European theater. So they're getting all the sort of like director driven weird movement theater coming from Berlin and Brussels. And they're like that definitely exists. Dublin has amazing TYA, Theater for Young Audiences. Really? Yeah, like, amazing theater for young audiences. Like, I didn't know that I enjoyed going to theater for young audiences as an adult until I got to Dublin. And then it's like, all of my favorite things that I'm seeing are, I'm twice the age of everyone else in the audience.
But it should still be fun. Yeah. It should still be fun. That's another hill for me to die on a different day. But like, Theater for Young Audiences is based around being able to explain the concepts in that way. It's available to a younger audience, but it doesn't mean it has to only be for the younger audience or shaped in that way. And that's, I'm going to get off my soapbox now, but that's just how I feel about that.
The biggest truth bomb ever is that Theater for Young Audiences is just theater for adults with all the boring parts taken out.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's all of the things. It doesn't have to be 3 hours. Not that I don't mind a 3-hour play, but also I kind of do mind, y'all.
Listen, it is great. It's playwright.
We do it.
If every playwright wrote their play as if they had to keep a 7-year-old's attention, like, we would just have better plays all around.
Please don't act like that's not about to be part of my dramaturgical, like, arsenal now, because it is. You just gave me a very strong weapon.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, we've talked a lot about theater. Let's talk about the non-theater things, especially because there was a long period where both of us, at least, and a lot of other people didn't do theater for a long time. What were you doing in the between time? What are the things that you do that aren't theater?
In the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. In the pandemic, outside, before, you know, we have whole lives.
Creative endeavors I've done that aren't theater. I love singing classical choral music.
That is news.
Yeah, I, like, I will sing the fuck out of a madrigal. I don't know, am I allowed to curse?
Yes, you're good.
Yes, okay. I love Renaissance music because it's, like, the Renaissance was kind of the time before time signatures and keys really existed, or, like, scales in the way we know them now, and, like, normal harmonic structures. So, like, everything's just really trippy. Like, there is no regular beat in some of these songs. There's no, like, ascertainable key or major or minor. It's just, like, you know, it's the time before all the rules were around, so it's, like, weirdly very experimental, and I love it. All of which is to say that I really love singing in a choir and have done so for almost my whole life, and it's really important for me to have, like, a creative outlet that is not theater, and that I also, like, have no aspirations toward, you know, like, I want to be good when I'm singing in a choir, like, I want to make sure I'm singing it well, but, like, I have no interest in being a singer or, like, being in the music world. And to just be like, okay, I get to do this just for me is so nice.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately. You know, like, what are the things that we... Because, like, it comes up every now and then where it's not weird being creative, but it's tricky because the work that you do is still work. And this is especially at least true for me in theater. And I think I've got my boundary on it pretty firmly. But, like, the work that we do is creative. It's an outlet. It's what we love to do. It's our passion. I think this is especially true for performers, and I feel for them in a very specific way, where it's, like, this is a thing that you love to do, and it fills you creatively, but it also is, like, your work. And you get paid for it, and you have to demand pay for it, and there's hours around it and business behind it, so it's not just an outlet anymore. So it's like, what are the things that you do that you don't have to worry about being good at, that you just get to do for fun, and that like don't have the pressure of like, well, can I be successful in this? Because it's just something that you do. And I just think about that a lot. It's like, what are the things that I do that I don't have to be successful at? Because I love theater and I love writing, but my writing is something I realized this like literally 2 days ago, where I'm like, I don't write because I'm good at it. I just do it because I'm fun. Like, I do happen to feel like I'm pretty good at it. I have been told that I'm good at it in certain ways, but for the most part, I didn't start it because I was good at it. I was just bored. And I was like, well, this seems like a fun thing to do, so I'm just going to do it. And I'm trying to find my way back to that idea of it, at least for that part of my life.
Yeah, something that I've been thinking about a lot is that, like, I have had a lot of success sort of revising my plays in pandemic times. I think being generative is a little harder for me. And I think it's hard to feel playful. It's hard to feel playful in our current environment, especially when, you know, the limits of my activity are so strict, you know, like routine is not conducive to playfulness or spontaneity or impulse. And I, you know, like, I very much have my quarantine routine. But yeah, I mean, like, I just wonder about, like, what are the things that make me feel generative right now? And I don't know what they are. And when I do get to generate, like, I'm so grateful for it and I'm so happy for it. But, like, I can't do that without a deadline. Like, I'm not just doing that for fun.
What are the things that push us?
What
are the things that push us forward? And sometimes it's deadlines. For me, I don't respond to deadlines. I just move them. But that's also because I've never been given a deadline that I really like had to absolutely follow. And that might be part of the trick. But I know when I give myself a deadline, I just kind of nudge it. I just like keep nudging it and moving it. But there's like creativeness in all hobbies. I was going to say, what are the non-creative hobbies you do? But that's not.
Okay, so now subjective. The moment where I talk about cooking.
Yes, do it.
Okay. I just have been pouring all of my heart and soul into cooking.
I love it.
I know people have different feelings on this. I love cooking with other people.
Oh, wow. That's new. That's not me. Talk about that.
Yeah. I love cooking with my mom. We're always talking, we're always in the same house, but there's something about like just like both being cooking that like facilitates really good conversations, and like we're often laughing so much when we cook. And like I have memories of when my grandma was alive, we'd like go to grandma's house and you know, my mom and my grandma would always be in the kitchen just like cooking and talking, and like we would like come in and out, but like that was their space, and I always knew that like magic was happening in there, you know. And there's something like I feel like I have joined that club by becoming a cook.
I love that.
I really feel connected to my grandma when I do it. I feel connected to that sort of like love she had with my mom when I do it. And I also just feel like, you know, I think there's something cool about getting to make decisions in a low stakes way. Be like,
yes,
you know, all the time I cook stuff and I'm like, this didn't turn out quite how I wanted it to. And you know what? That's fine. Like, I think it's a really low stakes way to learn from your mistakes. And just know that you want to do something a bit differently next time.
It's also playful.
Yeah, you do get to be sort of intuitive. Like all the time I'm just like, I'm just gonna throw some of this spice in because YOLO.
why not? Like, yeah, what's like, it gonna do? We'll find out.
Yeah, and if it's bad, it's one meal of my life, but it's never bad.
It's not. Like,
sometimes
yes.
it's bad. Sometimes I left some granola in the oven a little too long, and every morning I eat it, and I'm like, it's not burnt, it's toast flavored.
No, I've had a lot of, I spent a lot of the pandemic, like, really cooking, and I'm actually, like, honestly rather burnt out from it,
mm-hmm.
because I went full force, because I love to cook. It's been that way my whole life. My dad, you know, his first work was in kitchens, so that was a big part of our life in our home, and my mom also worked in restaurants, and that's kind of just always been how we are, and I think that's why, at least in my family, none of us are good at cooking with each other, because we all have, like, a very specific system and the way that we like to do it, and it's like, you can kind of be in the kitchen if you know how to stay out of the way correctly, mm-hmm. and, like, answer the right questions, but for the most part, if one of us is in the kitchen, the rest of us are not.
Mm-hmm.
But I really started doing a lot of, like, baking and stuff, because I realized, you know, when you work just takes up so much of our time, and you mm-hmm. spend time commuting, and you have to come home and do all of the things that you do when you settle in, so there's not time to, like, cook in a really just playful, fun way. And that was my time where I was like, I'm gonna just make cookie dough, I'm gonna bake scones, I'm gonna make bread, and, like, do all this random stuff. And now I'm just like, I don't even want to cook, like, pasta.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's just, there's so much joy and playfulness in what you get to do in a kitchen. And it is kind of, like you said, I didn't think about it this way, but it is really, like, low stakes. It feels very high stakes to me, because I'm just like, I really want this one meal in my life to be really good. But it is, like, low stakes. I made something. Oh, it was, like, some chicken thing, like, a couple weeks ago, and I oversalted the hell out of it. Like, it was inedible.
Mm.
It was terrible. And I spent not, like, too many hours on it, probably, like, one or two. And I just, like, I started eating, and I was just like, wow, this is inedible. This is not good. This is not bad. But this is definitely not good. This is not gonna work. And my solution was just, like, I'm just going to squeeze a bunch of lemon on it because it's acid, and then the acid will cut the salt, and we're just going to have to keep it moving because I spent 2 hours on this, and this is food for the week.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally just, like, think that it's really low stakes in that, like, you're like, okay, it's, like, one, maybe 2 to 3 meals of my life.
Right.
And then I don't have to deal with it anymore. And if you cook something and it tastes really good, it's just, like, the best feeling ever.
It's so rewarding. Yeah. And you just get to eat it, and you're excited.
Yeah. And I just, like, I think there's something so therapeutic about just, like, chopping and stirring and just the whole process, you know, like, to just, like, after whatever time at night, I'm just, like, I don't want to look at emails anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, like, chop up some Brussels sprouts.
Yeah.
And maybe write something.
It's very physical and, like, grounding, yeah. too. At least for me. Like, I just feel very, that's an easy way for me to get out of my head and, like, out of being on a computer screen all day and reading all day and all of these other different places, and just be like, I am in this moment. One of the things that I'm working on, that I've been working on for a while now, is just working on being present in the moment that I'm in, and not just, like, doing one thing and thinking about 5 other things, which mm-hmm. is very much how I always am. And that is at least one of the places where I know if I'm in the kitchen, because I don't want to hurt myself, and because there's live fire and sharp objects, I'm just totally there, and that's a nice space to have.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are some of the creations you've made?
So I have been working a lot on my shakshuka.
Really?
Because, my dad was a horrible cook. like, truly abysmal. But the only thing he ever made that was halfway decent was shakshuka. He made pretty good mm-hmm. shakshuka. And he was Egyptian. So it was like, you know, he never used a recipe. He just, like, yeah. made it the way he saw his mom make it. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, never got his recipe per se, but I'm like taking an interest in cooking as a way to sort of like unearth things about my Egyptian heritage. Davinia knows this already because
we just wrote a play about it.
But I'm Egyptian. I don't speak Arabic. I kind of like don't have a ton of knowledge about Egypt, although I've been there a lot of times, and I like love my family there, and I like, you know, feel like I know sort of the history and the culture academically, but not through lived experience per se. And cooking is just a really tactile way to feel connected to a culture.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. We have very, I mean, we're connected in a lot of different ways, but that I think is one of the ways that's one of the things that we share, and that I'm mixed, and my mom is from Guatemala, but my siblings and I don't know Spanish. And that's like, you know, that's its own thing that we can get into. But one of the things we didn't lose was food, because my abuelita would come over and, you know, make tamales during the holiday. My mom has certain things that she makes that kind of like you, she doesn't have a recipe for. I mean, I text my sister at least like once a month, and I'm like, how does mom make her black beans? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Why don't mine taste right? Why don't mine have the same consistency? And she's like, well, this is what I did last time. And I'm like, mom, what do you do? And it's just, it is one of those ways that even if you don't have language, you have food.
Mm-hmm.
And food is something that is so loving and comforting that it kind of like eases that, where you feel connected to it, even if it's something that is far away.
Yeah. For my mom's sort of like passed down recipes, the thing that always drives me crazy is that she doesn't put quantities. She's just like, taste it till it's right. Like,
No. It is so hard to do that.
Yeah. It's like, what if I taste it and it's not right and it's too late?
It is too late. I could tell you the pain that my sister went through trying to get my dad's mac and cheese down, mm-hmm. because he just makes it. We have no idea how he makes it. He never makes it the same way twice. And no matter how many times you watch him do it, it's just, it's never quite right. She's developed her own recipe that's like really good, arguably, sorry, Dad, better, but it's definitely not the recipe that he used. And it took her a lot of work to get that done. She is the hero in our family and the only one allowed to make mac and cheese.
Yeah, a lot of trial and error.
So much trial and error.
But yeah. I love cooking.
I would love to talk about cooking forever with you. But I do want to talk about the nonprofit organization for this week. And that is a completely different subject entirely, but still very passionate. And that we had a fun little thing where May actually was not our intended guest. If you listened to last week's podcast, you'll know I said Katie Nolan. But May is gracious and had time this week to be with us and is a lovely human. We're glad she's here. And May also would like this week to go to Black Girl Hockey Club, which is a nonprofit organization that is focused on bringing hockey specifically to Black communities, specific to Black women and young girls. And I really connected with this mission when I went to their website, because part of my dad's work with me and my sister and being young Black women was really making sure that we had access to things that people might have traditionally said we weren't allowed to have access to. That's how I got into horse riding. My sister spent a lot of time playing tennis, you know, really before like Serena and Venus like really, really blew up to the level that they're at today. So Black Girl Hockey Club is out here trying to just like put what would be seen as like, you know, technically a white sport or maybe an obscure sport, just something that like doesn't reach the communities that we necessarily think they do, and just like get women involved. They have scholarships programs, community programs, group connections to get these women on the ice and just bring them something fun that they love. And that is super exciting to me.
And I will just chime in and say, you know, as someone who sometimes exercises in a casual way, that I really do believe that we live in a society where health and well-being and fitness are a privilege so often, and everyone deserves to everyone deserves to move recreationally and to do so in a way that is physically and emotionally fun and rewarding for them. And for so many Black women, that might be hockey. If only someone were to hand them a stick.
Yeah.
You know?
And reach out to them.
Yeah.
I love that. So y'all can find out more about Black Girl Hockey Club on greatestcity.org/donate. I will check out their page, see what they're up to, see what ways you can support. And as always, you can donate right at our website to that organization and to the other two that we're running for the month of March. But for now, May, thank you so much for being here. This was so fun. It's always nice to talk to you. And I know we talk about your work all the time, but it's nice to talk about other things as well. So thank you.
Thank you. This was absolutely my pleasure.
I'm so glad. So next week, we will have Temidayo M.A., who is actually Helen Hayes Award winner. They're a writer, an actor, a producer, a healer. They're a yoga instructor, a queer activist. They do so many wonderful things. They are from Washington, D.C., so all of my D.C. native folks. This one is going to be for y'all, and I can't wait to see what we get into. See y'all next time.
Bye.